Hello, this is Chair Mike Freiberg. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Education Poli of the Preventive Health Policy Division to order. The clerk will take the roll for attendance for quorum.
Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Akam.
Present.
Representative Igbaje.
Present.
Representative Ackland.
Present.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson present.
Representative Franzen.
Franzen present.
Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Chair, you have a quorum.
Thank you. So next, could I get a motion to approve the minutes of February 24th, 2021? Representative Bierman, would you like to move to approve the
So moved, Mr.
minutes?
Chair.
Okay, the minutes have been moved. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye after unmuting yourself. Aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes are approved. So the first bill on the agenda, I think we might be taking these in the reverse order that they were posted online. The first bill is House File 313. Both bills are Chair Lee's bills, so this is Lee Day in the Preventive Health Policy Division. Welcome to the committee, Chair Lee. So I will move to the first bill is House File 313. Dealing with Alzheimer's disease. I will move to re-refer House File 313 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Division. And I understand you will have a DE1 amendment that would put the bill in the shape you like. Would you like me to move that first?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Sorry, I have a cat. Okay, opposed. Please say no. Okay, the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like. Chair Lee, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The amendment that we just adopted just clarifies the goals and the deliverables for the Minnesota Department of Health and creating the Alzheimer's Public Information Program. Additionally, it provides more direction to MDH regarding consultation with some of the targeted cultural communities that we want to for them to take a look at and to ask MDH to make materials available online at no additional cost to local and county public health, and provides that any funds remaining should be used to implement an initial statewide public information campaign using the materials that they develop. And also requires a report on and where the funds will be appropriated. And Mr. Chair and members, I really just want to say thank you to all of my co-authors from both sides of the aisles, and acknowledging the seriousness of this issue, and you know, really providing for this program, which will have $250,000 in funds to the Department of Health to develop a focused public awareness campaign with culturally specific messages about the importance of early detection and diagnosis awareness of Alzheimer's disease and other dementia, and discussing some of the cognition with a health provider. I do have some testifiers here that may be able to speak a little bit more, namely the Alzheimer's Association, and they have some constituents who can come by and talk about why this is important for them. And so right now, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over before questions.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Representative Heintzman, did you have a question like about the amendment before we get to public testimony, or did you just want to get on the list for after testimony is concluded?
I did have a question about the amendment, Mr. Chair. Just a process question. Did we get a description of the amendment before or after we voted on it?
I believe it was after, you know, it's fairly standard practice just to allow members to put to offer amendments to put bills in the shape they would like. I did ask if members had any questions regarding it, and nobody requested a description of it, but Chair Lee did describe the bill as amended in his
program. Mr. Chair,
Representative Heintzman.
If possible, maybe it'd be something that we could consider in the future, that we get the description of the amendment before we voted. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. So I do have a few people who have set, who are on the list to testify. I believe first is Josh Ney. Josh, are you here?
I am. Apologies, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Josh Ney, and I'm the manager of state affairs at the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about our support for HF 313. Thank you to Representative Lee for introducing this bill and to the bipartisan co-authors on the committee for your support. 99,000 Minnesotans live with Alzheimer's disease, and we estimate that number will increase to 120,000 by the year 2025. Two-thirds of those living with Alzheimer's are women, Black or African Americans are twice as likely, and Hispanic or Latinx Americans are 1.5 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's, but are less likely to get diagnosed than older whites. And according to data released just yesterday by the Alzheimer's Association relative to racial and ethnic attitudes around Alzheimer's, more than half of non-white Americans believe significant loss of memory or cognitive abilities is a normal part of aging. And more than one third of Native Americans and nearly 3 in 10 Hispanics do not believe they will live long enough to develop Alzheimer's or another dementia. Common misconceptions, fear, and stigma around dementia exist, which is why in part public awareness is so important. And I should clarify, Alzheimer's disease and dementia is not a normal part of aging, and it can impact those under the age of 65. Quality care for people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementia starts with an early documented and disclosed diagnosis. However, only about half of those with Alzheimer's have actually been diagnosed. Among those seniors who have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, only 33% are even aware that they have the disease. Early detection and a formal diagnosis allows people living with dementia to have access to available interventions, build a care team, participate in support services, and potentially enroll in clinical trials. 95% of those with dementia have other chronic conditions, including diabetes and hypertension, and a diagnosis that includes care planning for these conditions saves people with dementia and their caregivers from having to travel and pay for unnecessary hospital visits or trips to the emergency room. Alzheimer's disease is the most expensive disease in America. The average annual per-person Medicaid cost for someone without dementia is $374 versus $8,779 for someone with dementia. That means that a person with dementia costs Medicaid 23 times more than a person with dementia or without dementia, excuse me. In 2020, Minnesota, through medical assistance, spent $905 million on supporting those with dementia, and that cost is expected to increase by 20% in the next 4 years. But the Alzheimer's Association ran a financial model that shows we could reduce lifetime per person health and long-term care costs by as much as 15% or $64,000 just by diagnosing Alzheimer's earlier. Primary and long-term care costs are lower in people with diagnosed and managed mild cognitive impairment or dementia. Over the past half century, public health has provided leadership on the need for a diagnosis disclosure with other difficult conditions. Through public health education efforts and advocacy, healthcare providers are much more open and honest discussing difficult diagnoses like cancer or HIV/AIDS and relaying the impact of their diagnosis with care and understanding. We are seeking the same with Alzheimer's disease. Minnesotans must feel comfortable discussing symptoms and concerns with their healthcare provider. This requires addressing barriers, including low public awareness of the early warning signs of dementia, as well as the emotional distress and misconceptions about the disease. By making this investment to promote early detection and diagnosis, you can show Minnesotans that living with dementia can mean a more actively engaged life, a higher quality of life, and significantly reduce costs for health and social care. We ask the committee to pass HF 313 as amended. And Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, one of our Alzheimer's advocates, Lindsay Hilmer, who's on the list to testify, was unable to join us this morning, but I wanted to share her story and her grandmother's Alzheimer's journey with the committee. It's very brief, much briefer than my comments.
Sure.
I think it's important. I appreciate that. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Hilmer, and I'm from Alexandria, Minnesota. I grew up with my grandmother, Betty, who had Alzheimer's. My family did not have a history of anyone having any form of dementia or Alzheimer's. Betty was a widow and lived alone for 20 years. She was very active in bowling, gardening, art, and working. When Betty started forgetting appointments or birthdays, we assumed it was the normal part of the aging process. We figured that she's very independent, stubborn, and kept a very busy schedule. When Betty's undiagnosed Alzheimer's progressed, where we feared for her safety, we sought out answers as a family. My dad grew up only ever hearing of people being senile, but no one in our group of neighbors, friends, or family had ever had to deal with something like this. Had we known to recognize the signs of Alzheimer's and how it differs from the normal aging process, my grandma and my family would have been better prepared. It wasn't until Betty was in a full care Alzheimer's unit at the Glenwood, Minnesota nursing home that we really started to understand this disease. Betty fought this disease for 20 plus years. I share this story with you because I was robbed of my grandmother for nearly 20 years by Alzheimer's disease. Time where I should have been sharing my love of antiques, thrifting, painting, and gardening, all the things that my grandma loved. Instead, I had to learn empathy, patience, understanding. I had to learn how to comfort my crying grandmother when she'd tell me the other kids were being mean to her or that she failed a test in school. I had to believe for her sake that the stuffed animals in her room were real. I had to watch my grandmother reverse roles with me. That's why the Alzheimer's Association is working to pass House File 313, which would provide funds to the Minnesota Department of Health to establish a public awareness campaign around dementia and Alzheimer's disease and the importance of early detection and diagnosis. Please support House File 313 to provide awareness of the signs of dementia, to help reduce stigma of the disease, and to encourage Minnesotans to have conversations about cognitive health with their healthcare providers. Thank you, Lindsay Homer. And with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Knapp. Next, the testifier who signed up is Mary Margaret Lehman. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hello, do you see me? Am I there?
I don't see you, but I hear you.
Okay, let's see here. I don't know why. I can see you too, so that's good.
In the lower left of your screen, there might be a start video button.
Okay, yes. Yes, here we go.
There, now I see.
Okay, good. Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Margaret Lehman. I'm a caregiver for my husband, Ken, who is now 83 years old. It took 15 years and 9 physicians for my husband, Ken, to receive a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. 2 internists, 2 geriatricians, 3 neurologists, and 1 neuropsychologist. One geriatrician fleetingly suggested Alzheimer's and told us to come back in a year. I thought, how could this doctor even consider Alzheimer's? Ken had no memory issues. My father, my uncle, Ken's father all had Alzheimer's. They all had memory issues. Wasn't memory the hallmark of Alzheimer's? I began to observe changes in Ken in 1995. He was 58 and we were living in California. Most concerning were his problem-solving, judgment, and reasoning, particularly in regard to our finances, especially paying bills and taxes. Ultimately, more financial missteps resulted in bankruptcy and losing our home. We moved to Minneapolis and lived with our loving daughter and family for 6 months. A friend suggested we call the Alzheimer's Association Helpline. I now refer to it as my lifeline. Through the Minnesota North Dakota Alzheimer's Association, we were able to find a wonderful team of doctors who, after thorough neuropsychological testing, diagnosed Ken with Alzheimer's. Ken and I learned problem solving, reasoning, and judgment are warning signs of Alzheimer's. We learned there are actually 10 signs of Alzheimer's, that one person with Alzheimer's is one person with Alzheimer's. We committed to become advocates and educators with many other amazing volunteers from the Minnesota Alzheimer's Association to share our stories, the importance of early detection, and the latest research on brain healthy living, and the importance that persons living with dementia know that they are always cherished and always loved. But we need your help. The Minnesota North Dakota Alzheimer's Association needs your help. We are asking for a funding for statewide dementia public awareness campaign to give hope and support to the anticipated 150,000 persons living with dementia in Minnesota by the year 2025, so that we will all know everyone in Minnesota is walking beside us and we are not alone. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. That is all the people I've had who've signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, seeing no hands, we'll turn to member discussion. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing the bill forward. It is an area that we do need more discussion in public about the issue of Alzheimer's, and the growing numbers coming amplifies that to get people the help and support they need. One, I did have a question for Mr. Nye, if he's available, to discuss just briefly the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia.
Mr. Nye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Great question. So Alzheimer's is a form of dementia. It's the most common form of dementia. Think of dementia as kind of an umbrella term. There are different types of dementia. Alzheimer's is the most common form. Dementia is really a grouping of symptoms. And so depending on if you have Alzheimer's, Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal dementia, it all impacts the brain a little bit differently. But Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. Okay.
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And then just to follow up for Mr. Nye, you did mention the difference in the ratio of genders for this, and I wondered if you could comment on the numbers you're seeing of younger people afflicted with dementia or Alzheimer's.
Mr. Nye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Another great question. We are, unfortunately, people under the age of 65, as I mentioned, are being diagnosed with what's called younger onset, also known as early onset Alzheimer's. And this, the symptoms for this start as early as early 40s. I know of one of your former colleagues who shared a family member's journey where they were diagnosed in their early 40s with younger onset. Nationwide, there's about 200,000 Americans living with what's called younger onset, but that number is also increasing.
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nye, thank you for the answers, and I recommend positive quotes by everybody for this bill, because we need more discussion, more information, more access to services for people, and I think that it's we need more understanding about the results that people are affected with early onset, with Alzheimer's at any age, and just a better understanding among the public at large about what it is and what the treatment is, and get people the help they need sooner. Thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Is there any additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members for signing on. And like I have mentioned before, you know, to the bipartisan authors on the bill. And I will just share a little bit about, you know, why this is important for me and talking with Mr. Nye, who is a constituent of mine, and discussing this proposal before. I share with him the experience that I'm going through right now with my 76-year-old father, where one of the strongest person that I've known growing up, you know, similar to the story that he shared. And Just seeing, you know, cognitively, my dad has taken a step back. And so in trying to figure out the best kind of care for him right now, I know that there's a lack of information out there. And so what we're doing right here, and, you know, with the support of the legislature, is really getting out on the forefront so that we can have materials for families who are going through a similar situation like mine. And thank you to Ms. Mary Margaret Lehman for sharing her story, you know, that she is going through too. And so I just wanted to, you know, share a little bit about that and why it's important for me and why I you know, urge members of the committee to support this proposal. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I appreciate your commitment to this issue. It's affected all many of us, probably all of us. So with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 313 as amended to the Health, Finance, and Policy Division. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bierman.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Representative Aiken.
Aye.
Representative Agbaje.
Aye.
Representative Ackland.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, yes.
Representative Franzen.
Franzen, yes.
Representative Heintzman.
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Representative Pryor.
Aye.
Motion passes, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Somick. Your bill is on its way, Representative Lee. You also have House File 938 before us, dealing with child blood level reduction. So I will move to re-refer House File 938 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Division. Would you like to describe your bill, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, again, for the opportunity to present House File 938. This is a bill to address childhood blood lead poisoning in Minnesota. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, elevated blood lead levels, EBLLs, in young children are associated with adverse health effects, including learning impairment, behavioral problems, and even death at very high levels. And there is no safe level of exposure to lead. However, the threshold to that's used to trigger actions for investigation and remediations of sources of lead in the home for an elevated blood lead level is 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter. This was lowered from 10 to 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter in 2014. And so I'm bringing this bill forward because I believe that the Department of Health is right, that there's no safe level of lead at all, and that we really need to take a look at this at the legislature. And we know that lead, the burden of lead is disproportionately impacting children in poverty, and we need to make sure that we are addressing some of these causes of lead. And just to provide you some data, according to the Department of Health in Minnesota, about 15% of children under 5 years of age live in poverty. Children living in most of the counties in northern Minnesota are more likely to live in poverty than the state as a whole. And suburban counties generally have a lower percentage of children living in poverty. And in Ramsey County and areas of Hennepin County where I represent, we have a higher percentage of children that are living in poverty compared to the Minnesota average. And so just to bring it home a little bit before my testifiers start talking, in 2019, the department reported that about 7 out of 1,000 children tested under age, the age of 6 have an elevated blood lead level of which is 0.7% of the children tested, and the number has been decreasing over the last few decades. But you know, we are seeing that children in Minneapolis and St. Paul are at a higher risk of lead exposure, between 1 to 2%, which is double the state average. And in greater Minnesota, less than 1% of children have elevated blood lead level, about 0.8%, which is about the same as the statewide average. And so I think that this is important for us to really establish some goals so that we could get down to some of the national discussion around maybe lowering the threshold to 3.5. I think that it is necessary for Minnesota to move forward and you know, be a leader in this discussion. And so what my bill does is that it requires the Commissioner of Health to establish goals to reduce blood lead levels in children. By January 1st, 2023, no children in Minnesota shall have a blood lead level equal to or greater than 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of whole blood. And by January 1st of 2025, no children in Minnesota should have a blood lead level equal to or greater than 3.5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of the whole blood. The commissioner must establish a statewide comprehensive and coordinated plan to address and achieve these goals, and must administer the statewide lead surveillance system that they currently do, and really look at primary and secondary programs and other programs necessary to meet these goals. And so I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chair, and I know that I have some folks who are on here who can talk a little bit more about the environmental hazard of lead and also talk about their experiences with child lead poisoning in the state.
Thank you, Representative Lee. We do have a few people who've signed up to testify. The first is Dr. Zeke McKinney. And just so members are aware, Dr. McKinney offered to provide some background information generally on the environmental hazard of lead. I thought that would be helpful information for the committee to have. So he will be presenting a little more information than is normal for a public testifier, but I think will be helpful to all of us. So Dr. McKinney, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Hello, Preventative Health Policy Division members, and thank you for having me. I had the opportunity to speak to this division about 2 months ago regarding climate change. My name is Zeke McKinney. I'm a physician and researcher at Health Partners, as well as a faculty within the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. I'll try to keep these comments to under 10 minutes. Thank you. My specialty of occupational environmental medicine is not very well known, but tends to focus on environmental hazards. In my clinical practice, I actually primarily treat patients with concerns about environmental toxicology, which is exposure to dusts, chemicals, and molds, whether at home or at work, as well as complicated workers' compensation claims, which could also include issues of exposure, but could be anything. Incidentally, I'm also a new member to the Minnesota Biomonitoring and Environmental Health Advisory Panel through MDH, and I also serve as a state physician representative for the Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Units known as PSU. So although I don't treat children regularly, I do treat, or I would or can treat children and families with concern regarding exposure-related disease, and I think awareness of the capability is growing through, for example, the Minnesota Poison Control Center. In particular, I'm African-American. I grew up in North Minneapolis, and I'm a current resident of Northeast Minneapolis near the Lowry Bridge, notably a very industrial area. My Minnesota House District is 60A, and my U.S. House District is 5. I'm testifying on behalf of myself and not on behalf of any of the organizations for which I work or represent. So in terms of lead, it's important to know that the toxicity of lead has been known to regarding humans for more than 2,000 years, and there's really no disputing that fact. But what we've learned in recent decades is that even lower levels of lead than we thought are associated with adverse health effects, especially in children. Most importantly, when it comes to thinking about pediatric medicine or the treatment of children, we really rely on the tenet that, you know, children are not small adults. That is, metabolism in children is really very much different than it is in adults, and so consideration of health effects in that population is really important. In thinking about how we monitor lead and guidelines we follow, first of all, we need to understand how we measure it. So in 2012, the CDC responded to the Advisory Committee on Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention, the ACCLPP, which made recommendations about this. So prior to 2012, that is between like about 1990 and 2012, the blood lead level exposure guideline was 10 micrograms per deciliter, which then in 2012 reduced to 5. And that was based on the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, that is NHANES data, where they said, let's look at the 97.5th percentile of children's blood lead among children age 1 to 5. And they found that, you know, in that group, that was about 5 micrograms per deciliter, and that about 450,000 children in the United States were actually found to have levels higher than that. So that's where we came to that point. But what they said notably, and I'll just quote them directly here, is they said, the absence of an identified blood lead level without deleterious effects, combined with the evidence that the effects appear to be irreversible, underscores the critical importance of primary prevention. So in terms of measuring lead, we most commonly measure it clinically in blood, but that's mostly because that's really the most reliable and most available. The burden of lead in bone is really important, but measuring it in bone is really hard, and we don't really have ways to do it. Otherwise, we can measure lead in urine, saliva, sweat, hair, nails, even teeth. But again, clinically, we don't have that stuff very well available, and maybe are only available in research contexts. But what we do know is bone is a really interesting and important way to measure lead, simply because lead accumulates in bone over the lifetime, and so a lot of the body burden of lead ends up being in bone. And so as your bones turn over and regrow and change, some of that lead can be released into the blood. It's estimated about 76% of the body burden of lead is in bone in children. So that's important to keep in mind. And otherwise, it's in soft tissues and blood. So thinking about the health effects of lead, really, it's been found that lead essentially affects every system in the body that we can identify. So that means, importantly, the brain is probably the most concerning because we've seen these effects at even levels lower than 5 micrograms per deciliter in children. And then, of course, if children have impacts on their brain and their neurologic system and having cognitive effects from that, that's going to affect them in the long term as well. So we also see it affecting mood and behaviors, and that can be a problem. We see effects on the kidneys where, you know, it can impact how the kidney tissue works and how people can process things through their bloodstream. It has effects on the cardiovascular system, both in terms of blood pressure, an increased risk of high blood pressure, both over time, that's in kids and adults, changes to blood vessels, increased risk of heart disease. We see problems with blood because lead actually is very much involved in how blood is metabolized. We can, you know, kids can have risk of anemia, for example. We see changes in the immune system, that is how likely people are able to fight infections or disease and become sensitized to things. We see reproductive effects both in men and women, of course, in children who are growing and moving into puberty. That can be problematic. We see developmental effects even, you know, in fetuses in terms of birth weight and size. We see respiratory effects in as far as decreased lung function, increased risk of asthma, increased risk of other obstructive lung diseases. We see effects on the liver in terms of, you know, elevating liver enzymes and, again, people's ability to process toxins or compounds in the blood. We see problems with the hormone system affecting, you know, thyroid hormones, people's ability to grow, levels of vitamin D, which again also interplays with how bones are developed and continue to grow and change. My point is we've seen it pretty much across the board. We also know lead is carcinogenic, that is, it can cause cancer, has been named by the International Agency of Research on Cancer as a probable carcinogen, that is group 2A. In terms of prevention, we have to think about the different dimensions in which we can prevent things. So there's primary prevention, which is, you know, minimizing future hazards and exposures and addressing the determinants of health. There's secondary prevention, which is detecting and treating preclinical issues. This particular issue of looking at blood lead levels and changing the marker for that is a secondary prevention. Tertiary prevention, which is really decreasing the impact of illness, quality of life, and mortality. And then quaternary prevention, which is really making sure that medical interventions are minimizing harm and maximizing benefit. It turns out basically there's really no good way to treat lead exposure or absorption except at very, very high levels. And so really the most important thing is to identify and remove the sources of exposure. It also turns out that having a regular diet for children impacts lead absorption because how much calcium and iron they have in their diet can impact how much lead is absorbed. And also lead is absorbed more on an empty stomach. That leads us into routes of exposure. So the 4 primary routes of exposure when we talk about toxicology are ingestion, that is eating something or taking it through the GI tract, inhalation, breathing it in, dermal or skin exposure, and then I guess injection, though that's not as much relevant here. For children and adults, primarily ingestion and inhalation. Okay, well, thank you for the musical interlude. In any case, for children, primarily ingestion and inhalation are the primary routes of exposure. Dermal or skin exposure is really not as significant. For kiddos, they actually are exposed to lead like from soil or from other sources because of their, you know, hand-to-mouth behavior, which is really an inherent developing characteristic of children. But they can also be exposed through dust and food and water and a bunch of other sources. And also, again, as I mentioned before, because kids are not small adults, they actually absorb it through the GI tract much faster than water. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter how children absorb this. The toxic effects of lead are the same regardless of route of exposure. So because lead is, you know, a common element in the world and we've had it in a number of sources throughout history, you know, historically leaded gasoline that has been phased out in the 90s and even more in the 2000s. We've had it in lead paint until about 1978, so older homes are more at risk there. We see it in water sources, even though we can treat our water sources at the municipal level, you know, older homes still have pipes and fittings that have lead in them, and replacing all of those has not happened and probably is going to take a very, very long time before it does happen. We see lead in different industrial settings, whether it's mining and smelting, which maybe aren't as important here in the Twin Cities, but maybe are more important in rural areas. But then, you know, the manufacture and production of lead-containing products, which are paints, pigments, glazes, electrical shielding, plumbing, storage batteries, solder, welding fluxes, things like that, all speaking to my expertise as an occupational medicine doctor, but even in pesticides, or even in combusting coal and oil, thinking of power plants or waste incineration. So kids have exposure to lead through water, whether it's surface water, lakes and rivers, groundwater, drinking water. Urban storm runoff, industrial areas can be an issue. As I mentioned, soil can be an issue, especially in inner cities where we see the highest levels associated with proximity to traffic and industry. In air, again, this has historically been leaded gasoline, so that's been a lot reduced, but there are definitely places where that can be higher. We've seen levels of lead even in foods that kids eat, whether it's cereal, fruits, and teething biscuits. That tends to be low, but not zero. Some imported materials still have lead. Again, this has generally been reduced, but still not zero. Like some inexpensive jewelry still has lead in some of the painting or pigments related to it. Otherwise, pigments we see, like with ceramic materials, kids, if they're drinking out of ceramic stuff that somebody got in, let's say, Mexico, or plastic wrappers sometimes can be printed with lead-containing pigments. Lead can also be transmitted through breast milk, so exposure to adults matters. And then there are also para-occupational exposures, meaning if workers are exposed to lead, they can end up exposing their children. And we saw this most recently last year with Water Gremlin, a company locally that makes lead weights and sinkers, and we found that the children of the employees there had higher lead levels. It turns out lead is an issue of health equity because lead and other environmental contaminants tend to impact communities of color more significantly. The Minnesota Department of Health has shown that communities of color more commonly live in poverty, about 3 to 5 times more likely, and that kids living in neighborhoods with higher childhood poverty are more than twice as likely to have higher lead levels than kids who are living in neighborhoods with average or lower poverty compared to the society as a whole. This plays into social determinants of health, which are, you know, access to healthcare, health insurance, stable and safe employment, safe housing, including residential segregation and education, because all of these end up impacting exposures to toxic substances such as lead and our ability to intervene and treat these. Unfortunately, there's a lot of uncertainty. Exposures are not always clear, whether it's soil, air, or food, or any other sorts of source of exposure. Measurements not always perfect, you know, whether people are not showing up to clinic or we're not having ways to actually measure this. And then this conversion between blood and bone always plays a role in, unfortunately, increasing lead levels, even when we are doing things environmentally to decrease them. And then the outcomes are hard to measure too. You know, how do you understand cognitive changes in a child, you know, when you haven't, you know, had them in school or in a setting where we knew what their baseline was? And so if kids are having these impacts, we may not be able to impact them in early enough because we won't know what the downstream effects really are. So as a consequence, we have to emphasize and increase really these biomonitoring measures of secondary prevention so we can better identify and the means by which we can intervene on issues of primary prevention. Thank you very much for the time. That was about 12 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. McKinney. I have three people who have signed up to testify. The first is Angela Avent, and Angela will be Roxanne O'Brien.
Hi to everyone. I won't keep you long at all because I'm actually going to get them from doing a PhD right now. My son was diagnosed with having seizures in 2012. He was only 2.5 years old, 1 and 3. I witnessed my child urinate on himself, bowel moving on himself, all because of having lead poisoning within our home. So, speeding it up a little bit, 2014, everything seemed fine, cool. He went enough time without the medicine, so he was taking off of Keppra. Lo and behold, last Thursday, they said he may grow out of it, he may not have. His levels were so high, he was at an 8. So when they said he'll grow out of it and we hit 4 and he was doing great, I didn't think no more about it. Well, we were sitting at home planning a family vacation and we started talking about monkeys and he got really excited. And so I'm thinking he's tapping my legs to say, yay, mommy, let's go. And come to find out he's having another seizure. So right now, we don't know if it's going to be long-term, but I believe he's going to have to take medicine his whole life. I, myself, growing up being a young parent, I didn't know anything about lead until my son's level was super high. And that's when he started having seizures. So that's when I started doing research and different things. And then I had to move. And at that time, I was a single parent, and my income wasn't where it needed to be. So moving was like, oh, my goodness, like zero to none. So I just continued to believe that something was going to give up and something was going to change. I think impacting this, the impact of this on my life is long term. Like right now, I'm not even able to work because of the fact of he has to do home learning. The fact that they're doing his home learning and he's on the computer, it messes with the seizures as well. So all of this with a little knowledge of lead, I think it could have been prevented. And I think passing the bill that he's won the 3.5 level, I think it will be amazing. I'm sorry I'm getting a little emotional because I'm just like, I don't think no one should ever have to go through that, especially witnessing the thing, how your child just shakes and he's limp and there's nothing that you can do to fix or to help him at that time. You know, but my belief is I just continue to pray. And he ended up only being in it for about a minute and a half. He almost choked, you know. So it was a lot, you know, just having just a lot of flashbacks from when he was younger. So I just think if the words that I can maybe say can help prevent another child from being in that situation, I can. I'll do whatever I can to stand for these babies because they at least deserve the chance to be normal as possible, whatever the normal is as of right now. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you for sharing your story. The next testifier is Roxanne O'Brien, and after that will be Danielle Teachin. Roxanne O'Brien, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Roxanne O'Brien. I live in North Minneapolis. I have three children. I am a community organizer. I'm mostly known for environmental justice work against a facility called Northern Metals. I started working on that issue in about 2011. So I've been working on lead and asthma and environmental justice issues for over 10 years now, pro bono for the most part, because I actually was working on different issues when I found out about lead and how high our asthma hospitalizations were in our community. I was actually working on foreclosure prevention. So I did work with like the Homeowners Bill of Rights and working with a lot of people to just help our neighborhoods. I live in a neighborhood that's, if you know environmental injustice, you know that our neighborhoods are overburdened. So we have quite a few risks from everywhere, which makes our lives probably 100 times worse than other communities. It's really our lifespans are based on our zip codes. That's how bad it is. And so for me, my kids don't have lead poisoning or asthma, but I never thought that I would wait for the time to when my kids would be impacted by these issues. So I was angry from the start when I heard that there was companies in my communities like Northern Metals that were allowed to emit different pollutants. And one of the major pollutants is lead. So we have the highest spike of lead in our community. And again, I said I used to work on foreclosure prevention. I think something that's interesting that people don't connect, and that's pretty much, I don't know if I just did my 2 minutes already, but people don't connect the dots, and sometimes I have to do that. So like we have the highest rates of foreclosure in Hawthorne neighborhood, which I think is interesting because we also have the highest rates of lead over there. So when you think about this issue, it has a domino effect. It has implications that go on and on. So if people are trying to take care of their kids and taking them to doctor's appointments, they don't have time to work, so they could be falling behind on their rents or their mortgages. And then children aren't making it to school, so then the schools are losing money. The children are losing their opportunity to be educated. It goes on and on. So I'm here as a mom and an advocate and an activist, really just trying to get people to acknowledge how big of an issue that this is. We had one of the first times in history where we finally got some of the fine that was fined to Northern Metals, it would have went back to the state, but the first time in history, we got some dollars to be able to do some different asthma and lead projects over here. So I'm happy about that, but the money, you know, it doesn't go a long way. And I just, the last thing I want to say is I was in a college class called Managing Health and Stress at some point, and we had a whole debate in a class about whether or not cheap food was really cheap in comparison to healthy food. And when you think about the money that would need to be spent on prevention would be less than what you would need to solve this issue after the fact. So yeah, food may be cheap, or cheap food may be cheap, but in the long run, you know, you have to buy healthy food so that you keep your hospital bills down, or that you keep your health, you know, your health wealth. So thank you. I'm pretty sure I went over 2 minutes. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for your testimony. The last testifier who has signed up is Danielle Teachin. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Danielle Teachin. Props for getting my name right. That never happens. Mr. Chair, thank you, and committee members. You've had fantastic testimony by people, so I don't need to prolong this. I am live in North Minneapolis, and I am a community builder and organizer, and we've lived here for a really long time. A little like Roxanne, my children have not suffered impacts from lead. I do deeply believe in the ways that we can be eradicating and eliminating toxins in the community, particularly in overburdened communities. And my question, really, and my statement is that if it's within your power and control to eliminate a barrier that will add significant emotional, mental, financial burdens on communities, then that feels like that's the role that the committee and that decision makers have. There's no good level of lead, and kids are suffering. And I think it's part of our responsibility to protect our most vulnerable. And there's so many burdens, impacts, struggles that families are facing, particularly Black and brown and poor white communities. And much like Roxanne said, the way that just snowballs in the effects, and that the financial burden that families then have to fix the solution, and that oftentimes maybe a fix isn't even possible. So I definitely support this bill and want to keep working towards finding all the ways that we can be proactive in ensuring that kids aren't hurting, that they're not getting sick, and they're not suffering as that breaks down the strength of families when they have these additional burdens that they need to face. So thank you for your time and consideration.
I believe people from the City of Minneapolis Department of Public Health, as well as the Minnesota Department of Health, are available for questions, but that is everyone I have who has signed up to testify. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this? Okay, seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. I don't have any members with their hands raised at this point. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee, so much for bringing this forward. You know, I worked as a medical assistant and a phlebotomist at a community health center in Boston in the early 90s, and checking kids' lead levels was a big push and a big concern at that point. And here we are, 30 years later, with these same concerns. It's pretty heartbreaking and disappointing. I think that this issue touches on so many of the issues around health equity and disproportionate impacts. And it illustrates how the work that we do in our committees overlap and intersect. None of them exist in silos. We've heard from Dr. McKinney and Ms. Avent and Ms. O'Brien about how environmental impacts directly affect people's health. and how we're really letting Minnesotans down in terms of the levels of pollution that we allow and the monitoring of that pollution. This has been pretty heartbreaking testimony, but it should be a call to action. And I want to thank Representative Lee. I want to thank Dr. McKinney for your great work and the testifiers for your bravery coming forward to share your stories and your experiences today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Next member I have on the list is Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing the bill forward. Echo what Dr. Morrison said. I do have a question for Dr. McKinney. He did a great job explaining the multidimensional aspects of this problem and a lot of the study that he's aware of as far as what the results are to the human body. One question that came to mind was, I know you said it doesn't really matter how the lead enters the body, but my question is really, when you're measuring the blood levels and what organs are most affected, perhaps, can you determine the source of the lead physiologically? Does like some lead impact, can you draw the lines to what may have been the cause of that lead in an individual?
Yeah, that's a really. Oh.
It's okay.
Thank you.
Proceed, Dr. McKinney.
That's a really good question. So when we get a blood lead level, whether it's 2, 3, 5, 20, it does not tell us what the source is at all. So whether the source was air, water, anything, it's going to still reflect in that blood lead level. So no, unfortunately, we don't have good biomarkers of exposure in terms of being able to differentiate the source of the lead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one more follow-up then. Just so we don't know necessarily the source physiologically, but in your work, Dr. McKinney, can you say with any certainty of all the sources out there, are there some sources that are more dangerous right now to children or to the rest of us as far as exposure goes? I know we had the conversation on another bill about specifically the lead in paint, and that was very detailed. I heard it last session. I heard it again this session. You know, that's one area that I think affects every district here and would be a good starting point for us. But I'm just wondering about what other points of lead sourcing you might point to.
Yeah, I think it varies with the individual, and I apologize, Representative Freiberg, for interrupting if you're trying to let me speak. I think it really varies with the individual. As you point out, paint is a huge source that we know of, especially in older homes. I think for kiddos, soil is a big source, but it really depends on where you are and how contaminated the soil is, which is why we really need to continue to work on monitoring soil and then the people who live in those areas. I think para-occupational exposures, as I mentioned, can be a limited source depending on, you know, where a kid's family may work or how things are getting brought into the home. But overall, I think it's variable. I mean, as we saw in, for example, Flint, Michigan, water was a huge source. I don't expect that as much here. But again, in smaller cases, it may be depending upon the plumbing and the pipes in the home. So suffice it to say, I think we need to be a little bit broader about looking at both the individual and the sources of exposure, whether it's at home or other places people may frequent, and then being able to sort of correlate that data to figure out what our best means of reduction is. But that's why, for example, reducing leaded gasoline as a source of exposure in the air over the past few decades was a huge step. And by the way, I'll comment, probably a bigger expert on state lead than myself would be Stephanie Yendell from the Minnesota Department of Health. And so she may be able to answer some of these questions as well or better than I can.
Thank you, Dr. McKinney. I see Ms. O'Brien has raised her hand. Did you want to comment to this question?
Yeah, I did. I wanted to add, I didn't get a chance to, but, you know, I don't know if you guys were aware, but Henry and other schools in our communities, we had lead issues, or we continue to have them. I'm not really sure. I know we've been working on it, but we've had lead issues within the piping systems in our schools. And I also had talked to some inmates in Hennepin County who said that for a while there were notes on the drinking fountains that said, do not drink the water. And when people asked why, the guards were saying that there was lead in the water. And I tried to raise the flag about that, but you know, people don't really care about inmates too much. So it didn't go too far. But they were also forced to buy their water, and they can only buy 3 large liters of water per week, I believe, like the big 2-liter soda bottles. So they're forced to buy water or drink milk, or, you know, they don't have water. And then the other source, Northern Metals, was a very a big source, as we know. And not only was it a big source in the air, but, you know, what goes up must come down. So it went into the soil. It's also right there at our Mississippi River, which is our drinking water. Yeah, and then there's the lead-based paint housing issue. And so I just wanted to add that we've got multiple sources out here. And then the fact that places like Northern Metals had been around for 20 years, and people like me had been trying to raise the flag saying that something was wrong, but we had no proof of it until a whistleblower had came out and said him himself had been lead poisoned on the job. And that, you know, Northern Metals had lied at least 9 times on how much they were admitting into our community. So, you know, add up 9 times in just that 1 month that we found out, but they had been there for 20 years. So we don't know how long they had been pumping this stuff out. I just wanted to add all those, that's how you kind of see an overburdened community.
Thank you for your comments. Stephanie Andell, your name was mentioned. Would you like to identify yourself and proceed with your comments?
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Dr. Stephanie Andel. I work for the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm the supervisor of the Blood Lead Surveillance Program. And thank you to Dr. McKinney for doing a great job of describing how children are exposed to lead. I can talk a little bit more about how the public health systems work in response to elevated blood lead levels. So at the Minnesota Department of Health, we receive all blood lead test results, so from children and adults, as well as elevated and non-elevated test results. And for children with elevated test results, we initiate public health interventions. And so the law currently is written in Minnesota that at a confirmed level of 15 micrograms per deciliter, it's required that an in-home environmental investigation is performed. And so that's how we identify the sources for any specific individual child. The state of Minnesota performs those investigations for most of the state, but the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul Ramsey County perform those investigations within their jurisdictions. The city of Minneapolis and St. Paul Ramsey County have been able to add their own additional resources, and so they perform assessments at lower blood lead levels than the required 15 micrograms per deciliter. And what we see is that in about 70 to 80% of those instances, the children are living in homes with lead-based paint. And so that's why that does show up frequently as a source. For any kid, the most dangerous source of lead is the one that they have access to and are exposed to. For the other kids that are not living in homes with lead-based paint, we see a mixture. We see some kids that were exposed to lead before they moved to Minnesota and don't have current exposure, but it was identified here. We also see, as Dr. McKinney mentioned, a variety of other sources, including the take-home lead exposure from a parent's hobby or occupation, as well as imported products or products that contain lead, such as we occasionally see a toy or some other item like that that should not have lead, but does. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bierman, any follow-up?
Mr. Chair, just to follow up and a comment. This is really good information. There's some really good testifiers here who know this issue, and I would just point out that despite the cost on this bill, the results and the health benefits and the financial incentives for us to actually save money in the long term in healthcare would be substantial, and it would be tenfold what this bill will cost. And I just think that's something that members should think about when they consider this bill, because there's a lot of seemingly intractable issues we deal with. So many of them are like this one. If we invest and put the money in there, we have results that will, in the long run, save us some money. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Ekbadje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this forward and to all the testifiers. As people have said before, this is very important that we're focusing our attention on this issue, particularly as the Preventive Health Division. You know, I see this as a way of not needing to wait to decrease the harmful impacts of what we know are harmful toxins in our environment. And actually, by doing something like this, we can actually like increase the wellness in our communities by, you know, essentially heading it off at the pass and knowing the places that there are concentrated levels of lead that could be harmful to our children and their families. So I'm really glad about that. And also reading through the bill, I see that the report actually asks for action steps that are being taken once it's identified the areas. And so I'm grateful to see that. So we just don't have continued reports on the shelves that, you know, it's a good information, but we don't do anything with it. So I'm hoping that those action steps will shine light and give a greater impetus to fix the, you know, buildings, schools, pipes, soil that may have lead in them, and that we can have a really strong focus on what those remediation efforts look like after the hopeful passage of this bill. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Ekbadje. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this bill forward, because this has been, among other things, just a really great education this morning. And I know when my grandkids got tested for lead and they found traces of lead in their blood, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, what level of lead is safe? And the answer being no level of lead, you know, there is concern for all of us thinking that this is something that's happening to our children. So I have a couple questions, and I just to make sure kind of understand, especially, and I actually have two questions, Mr. Chair, if that's all right. Kind of a preliminary question, which is to understand again the sources of lead. So especially given the testimony from Dr. Yendel about when we trace back, it seems that the lead paint is the primary source. But can we also just talk a little bit about, you know, the water sources and pipes and soldering and things like that. So if we move to testing more children when we're detecting lead in their blood, do you think there would be more sources that come forward as being more causes as being the source of this? Or is it likely to be that we just sooner detect something, you know, this common, you know, I, putting aside those specific things like an adult bringing into the household and the ceramics and things like that, but what might be something common in the environment for all of us? Basically, I'm wondering about lead pipes and that sex, that part of a potential source.
Dr. Yendel, you want to take this or?
Yes, I'm happy to. And thank you so much. Yes. You know, there was a great paper by the EPA a few years ago that looked at various sources for kids, including dust, as well as lead in water and food. And we do see that at lower blood lead levels, even though the overall exposure to lead is smaller, proportionally on average, more of that exposure is coming from water and it's coming from food versus the kids with the really high levels, which are the ones that we're currently doing the in-home investigations for. It tends to be more commonly the dust. And so that was a really great point that as we're looking to prevent lead exposure, we are looking across multiple sources. And as we do go to lower and lower levels, you know, the city of Minneapolis has been responding at levels of 5 micrograms per deciliter and above. And at those levels, they are still seeing paint dust show up again and again and again. But to truly prevent all lead exposure, we are going to need to look comprehensively at additional sources, including those that create a much smaller contribution to the overall burden of lead.
Thank you. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, that was my question much more articulately answered than I asked it. So thank you for that. And then if I can go back to the bill author, Representative Lee, we're well, you know, we've heard some really compelling testimony, and thank you, Dr. McKinney, for laying out so much information about the long-term effects of lead in for children. And if we, so I guess it kind of says this bigger question, you know, if we're actually going to end these, if we're going to stop the exposure in the environment, you know, there would be a cost to that. Representative Lee, can you talk a little bit about, you know, basically the cost of not doing it? Will we have children grow up and that brain development at those early ages when they have that exposure? What happens if we don't fix this problem and get the lead out of our environment? What's the cost in the long run to us in the U.S. and in Minnesota?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pryor, for the question. And I have asked the same question to our nonpartisan House researcher. And as they were digging through this, you know, we can't really quantify a number, but they have shared that, you know, the Department of Health in 2014 had a report called The Economic Burden of the Environment on Two Childhood Diseases, Asthma and Lead Poisoning in Minnesota. And locally, they were able to quantify about a lifetime earning loss of about $1.9 billion in 2014 dollars. And then as we dig a little bit deeper, nonpartisan staff was able to find a national report. And I do want to note that this is back in 2009, but the national report identified that the national cost for healthcare is estimated to range between $11 million and $53 billion. The lifetime earning loss is between $165 to $233 billion. Lost tax revenue is between $25 to $35 billion. Into our education, you know, on special education, it's about $30 to $146 million. And for crimes, around roughly $1.7 billion. And so, Mr. Chair, I could share these two reports with the community administrator so that you could disperse it out to community members to check it out as they please. And so just appreciate the question, Representative Pryor. I think that this is something that we can't really quantify, but when these reports are lurking at some of these different cost estimates, this is what they came up with.
Thank you. Yeah, and please do share those with us, and we will make sure that committee members have access. Representative Pryor, any follow-up? Okay. Is there any additional member discussion? I have no members on the list at this point. Okay, seeing none, Representative Lee, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the conversation on this bill to really, you know, start putting the state of Minnesota towards the path of, you know, being ahead of, you know, the rest of our colleagues in the state and really addressing blood lead poisoning in our children. We have heard from Dr. McKinney. I really appreciate, you know, the extensive coverage to this issue that you're paying on, you know, for in your presentation today, and also to the three testifiers, Ms. Avant, Ms. O'Brien, and Ms. Tijan, who are, you know, residents and constituents of both myself and Representative Abaje, and really sharing their story so that as we look at this issue and make decisions going forward, that we highly consider this as a part of our work. And so thank you, Mr. Chair, and I encourage all of your support.
Thank you, Representative Lee. I appreciate your work on this important equity issue and bringing such knowledgeable testifiers, including ones with firsthand experience. Really appreciate hearing it. And it's, I agree, it's a really critical issue. So with that, I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 938 to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Bierman.
Yes.
Representative Grünhagen.
Yes.
Representative Akam.
Yes.
Representative Egbaje.
Yes.
Representative Ackland.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Carlson, yes.
Representative Franzen.
Yes.
Representative Heintzman.
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
Yes.
Representative Pryor.
Yes.
The motion prevails.
Thank you. Thank you once again, Representative Lee. Both your bills are on their way. Appreciate you bringing these to our committee. So I have no further business. I don't see any member discussion. So with that, this is adjourned.